court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Afternoon. Today we'll be hearing as our last case in February 2005, AP 2778 CR, State v. Post. Arguing on behalf of the state is Attorney James Frymuth. Haven't seen you for a while.
Yeah.
Oh.
A whole
different
setting.
Nice to have you around.
Moved around for the table. It's hardly that we recognize you.
May it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General James Frymuth, representing the state as petitioner in this criminal case. On a plea of no contest, defendant Robert Post stands convicted in Sauk County of fifth offense drunk driving. The Court of Appeals reversed the conviction and remanded, ordering suppression of evidence derived from the investigative stop of Mr. Post's car. Unlike the trial court, the Court of Appeals concluded that the officer who made the stop lacked reasonable suspicion to believe that Mr. Post may be driving while intoxicated. The state asked this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and reinstate the judgment of conviction, thereby affirming the trial court's determination that the investigative stop was lawful. With respect to the legal issue presented, because reasonable suspicion for an investigative traffic stop depends on the totality of the circumstances, right-line rules generally aren't feasible. However, because reasonable suspicion is also a Fourth Amendment question, each published case effectively articulates a constitutional rule based on the constellation of factors in that case. With that in mind, with respect to this case and the factors in this case, I offer two possible holdings, a very narrow holding and a much broader holding. With respect to the narrowest holding, this court should hold that an experienced patrol officer's observation of a car drifting or weaving back and forth in an S-type manner from inside an unmarked parking lane to the yellow center line several times within two city blocks, absent obvious explanation for it, gives the officer reasonable suspicion to make a traffic stop for possible drunk driving.
Should we put in there the time and date?
You could put that in there as well, sure. I mean, every case has all these factors, and that's what makes comparison sometimes difficult.
Counsel, you took away one of my questions. Is drifting the same as weaving? I drew an S.
I think it's a semantical choice. I was looking to see if I could find anything, any police officer manuals or anything that would suggest there's an articulate difference, and I couldn't. I guess drifting might, if you looked at this dictionary definition, might be just sort of one way, whereas weaving clearly, I think, suggests going both ways. But in any case,
that's what I was. You can drift.
I think rather than the choice of the word drifting or weaving here, or even erratic or eccentric or smooth or jerky, you look at the specific description of the movement, and in this case it was S-shaped this wasn't just the narrow lane of travel that he was in, but there was a parking lane, although it wasn't marked, and he was drifting towards that curb, into that parking lane, and then back to the center line.
Was that an inexperienced patrol officer?
He's an experienced patrol officer?
Inexperienced. Yeah. Someone who's on 2 weeks, five months, 6 years.
Okay. I would suggest in this case it wouldn't take much experience, and in fact a layperson here would have reason to suspect.
Okay, so we can knock out experienced patrol officer. You can knock out experience.
For this case, you wouldn't need that for your holding. I'm suggesting that there may be a case, which is even closer, if you will, and where the fact that you have a patrol officer who's on the road 6 hours a day, I believe this officer indicated, enhances the ability to recognize conduct that otherwise might be ambiguous, but in a particular case would be clearly suspicious of drunk driving.
How many times?
What's the broad holding that you're suggesting?
The broad holding would be, and somewhat in accordance with the cases that I listed in my brief, would be this, that an experienced patrol officer's observation of repeated, and the emphasis here is on repeated, drifting or weaving of a motor vehicle within a single lane of travel should be enough absent any obvious explanation for it, for reasonable suspicion.
What's the difference between the two?
Well, the first one is much more fact-specific to this case, talking about the S-shaped manner. I'm using the terms here, weaving and drifting, without describing them. That's the broadness of the broad ruling. But the case law, if you look at some of the cases, they don't often go into more than that description also. And the emphasis, I think, and the distinction between the state's cases and the defendant's cases in many instances is the difference between a single slight deviation and repeated conduct in a space
now,
of time.
Your narrow rule is on page 1 of your reply brief. Is that right?
I think that might be the broad rule. Let me look.
It says drifting back and forth in an S-type manner from the parking lane to the yellow center several times within two blocks without obvious innocent explanation gives an experienced patrol officer a reasonable suspicion.
That's right. That's
the
narrow.
That's the narrow. Okay. That's page 1.
Okay.
Now, I was trying to look the other one. Your test is pages 23 and 24 of the red brief. Let's see.
The broader one is in the
summary.
Point heading, I think.
Pardon me?
I think the broader rule is stated in the point heading, perhaps.
It's in the summary, I think, on page 23, in advocating general proposition, the repeated single-lane weaving of a motor vehicle absent any obvious innocent explanation gives an experienced patrol officer reasonable suspicion.
Right.
That's the broad rule.
That's the broad rule.
Okay.
Mr. Freimuth, I guess I have a question about the proposal of the broad rule. I used to hear a ton of these things in the 12 years that I heard drunk driving cases on two different levels of the court system. And my understanding of the case law is that what we looked at was the totality of the circumstances. And so when I think in terms of the totality of the circumstances, I know as a trial court judge, what I would look at when these reasonable suspicion cases came in was the totality of the observations regarding the driving that took place and the entire description of what we were looking at from the driving aspect. Why should that not be the test here? Why should we narrow it down to something more finite?
I'm not suggesting that it isn't. It is a totality test. I'm just saying that every case is going to stand on its facts as a constitutional rule. And so, you know, you can make the rule as narrow as broad as you want, depending on what you think is always going to be enough. And I'm suggesting here on my narrow rule, when you put in all those specific factors, all those totality factors of the driving and the road conditions and the number of times, the distance traveled, the nature of the frequency of the movements. When you put all those things together, you can come up with, and under the facts of this case, come up with that narrow rule that says under facts A, B, C, D, and E in this case, that's reasonable suspicion, so that in a future case, if you've got all those factors, you've got reasonable suspicion. You never say never because we're talking totality, but I'm just saying that's a way of articulating a rule here that will be of assistance to courts, to officers, to the public.
You had more to say, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
You talk about the totality of the circumstances, and one of the circumstances that plays large in my reflection on this case is how wide is that lane? And that's what causes me to balk a bit at your broad holding. It seems to be an experienced patrol officer, number one. You need repeat drifting or weaving within a lane. Now, under the Motor Vehicle Code, I think a double highway is anywhere from 20 to 24 feet, so a single lane would be 10 to 12 feet.
Sure.
What if in your general rule we had a 10 foot, a narrow but yet still within the Wisconsin Administrative Code, Department of Transportation regulations?
My argument would be that there you'd have to, again, look at the totality. And if you had this kind of conduct, let's say here we've got your 24 foot space, basically. I think the officer said 22 to 24. Because we're talking about basically a single lane and then the parking lane. But if it's just a single lane and you've got this kind of weaving several times in a relatively short distance and no obvious explanation for it, I think you've still got reasonable suspicion, because reasonable suspicion is designed, well, there's, it's a balancing test, and that's where I was going next. But
well,
go ahead if I'm
wrong. I think that your broad rule, I hesitate towards, because I might see it differently. If this is still within a regulated size, that is the DOT trans 205.03, it can be 10 feet. Well, you know, going back and forth a little bit, drifting a little bit in a 10-foot lane, I'm not sure that's it. But here, when the DOT regs say two lanes are usually 20 to 24, and that's what he had. Now, in my mind, it makes a big difference if someone has the width of what normally is two lanes, but here, because it's a parking lane, we're only referring it to one lane. It's almost like a fiction. He's got 20 to 24 feet to weave around. That makes a big difference to me, and yet your broad holding is eliminating that consideration.
Sure. And in response to that, it's obviously going to be a judgment call whether in your scenario, which isn't this case, in your scenario, whether that would be enough. And I think that's where you look at the balancing test that I've, and that is you look at the individual interest here with an investigative stop, traffic stop, and you look at the various interests of the state and the public here. Even in your scenario, when you've got a car that's doing this repeatedly within that, even within that single lane, it seems to me that the minimal intrusion of a stop, that all the officer is doing is fairly anonymous. You're stopping the car. The officer, especially if it's experienced, can tell the telltale signs, slurred speech. Although if he's arguing in court, slurred speech might not be the odor of intoxicants, bloodshot eyes, that type of thing. So it can be a quick encounter, the individual intrusion.
But the point is, if you can stop on reasonable suspicion of intoxication, it turns out there is no smell of intoxicants, no blur, no glassy eyes, no slurred speech. The officer, though, once he stops that car, can go much further.
I don't think necessarily that's true. I mean, I think if that's the basis for the stop,
well, then he says, you can go, thank you, I've seen your license, you can go, oh, by the way, may I search your car?
Sure. You can. Mm-hmm. The officer can expand it, but then you have to justify that expansion.
Yeah, but we've got cases which seem to indicate it doesn't take too much to justify that. And I remember the Badger Stop case. Mm-hmm. And what you needed was it 9:20? It was, I don't know, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
And it wasn't in, this was Sun Prairie, right?
Sauk Prairie.
Pardon?
Sauk County.
Sauk County. Wasn't in Sauk County. It was on the I-90 system. I-90 system and the theory of that there was suspicion about drugs because this was a route that an experienced officer would think that there was drugs. Well, you know, experienced officer can think at 9:20 is the time when people before the bars close, but after a heavy dinner and drinking, go home. I mean, there are all sorts of things in here, or take drugs or whatever. So once you authorize that officer to stop that car, then a lot of other things fall, right?
Well, again, I think you have to justify if you take mm-hmm. conduct beyond the stop, and your stop is based, and I didn't argue caretaker here because this officer was based solely
on
drunk driving.
Mm-hmm.
And once that concern is either dispelled or confirmed, then whatever happens next, I think the officer has to justify. And I think here, I mean, there wasn't a question because he found not only reasonable suspicion at that point, but probable cause.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that a lot of this is factual. It's common sense. I think if I were following a car and it was weaving within its lane, I would be I'm talking about just an average citizen would be sensitive to maybe you'd want to pass the person to not have anything happen. So that it's a matter of degree.
That's
I guess that's what I see it.
Reasonable suspicion is less than probable cause for a reason, and that is reasonable suspicion is designed to address ambiguity. For example, I'm sorry.
How long were these blocks? I mean, we're talking about two blocks.
It just says
right?
Two blocks. It wasn't developed as to the length.
We don't know how many times he weaved.
Several was the testimony.
Several means more than two.
Correct. I looked it up.
It does
say that. It says more than two or three is what it says.
We had a big debate about this.
In fairness, in the cross-examination that a fellow counsel said, well, could it have been a few? And then the officer said, few, several, all depends on. So it wasn't spelled out specifically. And it would have been helpful. I'm not saying it wouldn't have been. But I'm still suggesting that when you've got, and I put the emphasis here on at least more than one.
Okay. Suppose there were four blocks and they only weaved in the first two.
I think what happened was he saw the defendant's car driving in mostly in the parking lane. So he got suspicious and started to follow. Then for a two block, and I'm not sure how far it took him a few blocks to really catch up, I guess. And then he followed for two blocks is where he saw the S-shaped weaving. Then he went another five blocks and they made that left turn and that's where the stop happened.
So in three blocks, he didn't see them weaving?
For the next couple blocks, he did not, I believe, or at least he didn't testify to that. But if I may, I drive
in the parking lane on East Washington all the time when there are no cars. You're allowed to do
that. It's not illegal to do that, but I'm just suggesting that when somebody is going like this, it's a little different than just going in a straight line. On the government side of this balance, which I think is to this point not being maybe sufficiently addressed, let me suggest that when you have that kind of behavior, even in the narrow lane, there's concerns about whether the person will be able to react to something, another car coming, somebody runs in the road, whether this person, even though he may not be doing anything technically illegal in terms of the traffic law, down the road a couple blocks, If this had gone on for more than five blocks, say another mile, maybe he does then cross the lane and does cause damage or injury.
Mr. Freimuth, if I could, in looking at the totality, and what I used to focus on was totality of the driving, should this court be at all concerned about the fact that other than the weaving here, we don't, at least according to the record, have any indication that the vehicle was either committed any traffic violations, but more than that, not varying its speed, not driving in a jerking fashion, not stopping mid-block, not doing the other things that are normally indicative of drunk driving that an officer would isolate. Since we're supposed to look at the totality, and as I say, I think it's, you look at the totality of the driving, since that's all we're looking at here. We don't have anything else to focus on for reasonable suspicion. Does the absence of anything else, does that weigh in here and make a difference?
Well, I think if you had those additional factors, certainly as some of the cases suggest, that certainly pads reasonable suspicion. My argument is that once you've got that weaving and if you've got it consistently, even under the additional considerations of speed and technical traffic violations, that you've got enough here for an investigative stop. And it's a tough judgment call, and granted, the cases haven't been exactly 100% on this, and I'd be the first to acknowledge that. But I suggest that most courts, and under these facts, most courts would find reasonable suspicion.
This is inside a city?
It is inside the city, as I understand it, correct.
The weaving that you're talking about, is it more suspicious inside a city or on the highway?
That's a tough question. I guess it depends on the distance traveled. Certainly the higher the speed, the more weaving is arguably going to be more of a concern on a highway, perhaps, because of the speed involved, so that the ability to react, for example, to something untoward or unexpected that happens is going to be, your reaction time is based on the speed alone is going to be different. In a city, arguably, that isn't as the speed, if the speed limit is considerably less. But I don't think that means that person isn't a risk, not only in the moment, but that down the road, and especially if that person proceeds onto a highway, for example, is going to cause trouble. It's a tough balance, I think.
How fast was this vehicle going?
I don't recall if that was in the record. I don't know if that was developed. I'm guessing in the 30-mile-an-hour range. I reread the transcript right before this, and I just don't recall seeing it. I can look again and certainly
I don't recall the speed, but there was an indication that there was no testimony that it was either too fast or sometimes too slow driving
is an
indication of intoxication.
Just right.
It was just right.
Well, when you're in a city, you're normally traveling 25 or 35. That's
right.
Something like the speed limit. It seems to me the slower that you're going, in a sense, makes weaving a little bit more problematic in a way.
I would agree, if you think about it. And I think if you were a driver behind this car, and in fact, it's usually slow speed that is what prompts an officer to be concerned. So when you're going at a slow speed and you're not able to maintain your straight line at a slow speed, I think you're right. I think that is more indicative.
What if this had happened at 9:30 a.m.?
I think you still got still have reasonable suspicion, but I don't think the time here is critical. I think the fact that it is nighttime and the fact that it is arguably, and I looked to see when businesses in Sauk County normally, if there was any ordinances, but I didn't find anything helpful on that. But if 9 o'clock is normally the time for closing of retail businesses, after that fact, I would suggest that perhaps the person is out for reasons as attendant, going to a bar or something like that. So to that extent, it might differ. But I don't know that it's a critical component here.
Let me ask this. We know, because of the record, what the blood alcohol content was here. And it's hard to ignore that. But how many people are going to be stopped who are innocent, who really haven't had anything at all, and how low are we going to take reasonable suspicion? I mean, I think that's got to be a concern of everyone on the court.
I agree. I guess in response to that, I would suggest that when we're talking about the potential harm that can be caused and the fact that that even at a .05, which is legal to be driving at that .05 BAC, that your ability to react and to your ability is impaired even at that low a level. So I guess, and also in response, I guess I would offer the sobriety checkpoint case, where SITS is the U.S. Supreme Court case, where because of the importance and the significance and the concern about drunk driving, you don't even need reasonable suspicion for sobriety checkpoints. So even in under your scenario, you're talking about a lot of individual drivers who are obviously being stopped for no reason at all, where there is no reasonable suspicion. So I guess what I'm saying is you shouldn't be too concerned about drawing the line for reasonable suspicion too low, certainly on the facts of this case.
Well, maybe not on the facts of this case, because you advance a...
No private conversations.
If I may tell you a personal story.
Okay. I'm ready.
As long as it's not about me.
It's Friday evening, last Friday evening. And I'm driving along. It is in Waukesha County. And there's no question there was reasonable suspicion to stop me because my right front headlight was out. And an officer came up to me, and I had no problem. My license is out, and I didn't realize the headlight was out. But then the officer is looking and says, "You have 2 bottles of mouthwash down there. Have you been drinking?" I've got to be careful what I say.
You pause momentarily.
I mean, it seems to me... exactly what the chief said. I mean, you got this low threshold, and then it's an invitation to go way beyond that. That's very troublesome to me.
I guess obviously the factual differences between the weaving stop and this stop. But once you're there, The officer, I agree. The officer is in a position where he can notice things, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Plain view.
Exactly right. And I'm not, you know, I sympathize with your situation, but I'm just suggesting that I'm...
Well, why did he have the mouthwash?
He's not telling me.
The inference is he's trying to hide something. I mean, that's a reasonable inference from an experienced police officer. It's like the case we had where they had all of these deodorant things.
Oh, yeah. I am obviously
suspicious.
Sure.
That's right.
When you have...
Go ahead.
I hope that the court isn't going to tell personal tales because I was...
Do you have one?
Well, I have one. But it's a light out where the officer stopped me and I looked at my speedometer and I said, oh, I know I was speeding. He said, I didn't stop you for that. He said, I stopped you for the...
That was volunteered.
I stopped you for the light out. But then my passenger was my son-in-law. He asked him for his ID. And I wondered why can he do that? But between the time my son-in-law gave the ID, I gave him my ID, and then the officer took him back, and my son-in-law said, how come they can check you? And I said, ooh, I think that's one of the cases we wrote. The point is that sometimes they do go further. That's all I was saying.
Certainly, and I see my time is up, but if I may...
And aren't you fortunate?
Well, if I may, just
there
in
are
response...
No, there are, anyone else have a tale?
Sure. Before I hang around, we'll be happy to all tell
something. Go ahead.
I'm kidding.
He has something else he wants to say.
Go ahead, Mr. Simon.
Just in response to your scenario, I don't think the officer could do more than that without probable cause to search, for example. I mean, he could... Once he stops you for a traffic concern... And certainly I don't think anybody would say that having a headlight out, for example, is a valid basis for an officer to be concerned and make sure you realize that, if nothing else. Once he's in that position, things can happen, granted. But before the officer can do anything substantial beyond that, there has to be, you know, the problem.
Can he ask him to step out of the vehicle?
No, now I hesitate because I haven't done enough of these to know how far you can go.
But and then once you do that and there's a stop, then the question, and he's wearing a bulky coat. It was very cold out.
With his hands in his pocket.
And his hands are in the pocket because he forgot his gloves. You know Dave Prosser. And the result is he's now hand frisk you, I suggest. I mean, now, that's the problem.
Right. And I don't know what the case law is on hands in the pockets, but I'm thinking that.
It's mixed.
Yeah, I'm going to say I don't think that necessarily is going to be enough. So, but it depends on, I mean... All these circumstances are all relevant, but again, here we're talking about reasonable suspicion for the stop, not what happened thereafter, because what happened thereafter here clearly was probable cause for arrest. Thank you.
This is a serious case. I mean, we have been joshing about
it
to some extent, and I don't want you to leave.
Absolutely.
I mean, I know you know the court well enough.
Absolutely.
Because it's very serious, because sure. We're dealing with drunk driving.
Exactly. And it's serious on two levels. It's serious on the public who's being affected, and it's serious for the driver and any driver who's
stopped. That's right. It's serious on the Fourth Amendment, too.
That's
and
right.
Where you draw the line short of saying you can search anybody because there are a lot of drunk drivers and there are a lot of people that have drugs in their cars, et cetera.
That's
and
right.
That's what the court faces.
A real quick last comment or a story of my own. In response to the Court of Appeals per curiam in this case, I did get some calls from Sun Prairie Sheriff, I believe, concerned about that this was something that they normally consider single-lane weaving reasonable suspicion. So there is certainly going to be concern out there as to how the opinion comes down. So
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frymuth. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Kelly, we welcome you back.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Chris Kelly. I represent Robert Post in this appeal. I think there are really two questions before the Court today. The first is what the rule should be, and we suggest that the rule is that if a police officer observes no traffic violation, a stop based on a suspicion of impaired driving requires some observation of erratic or unsafe driving. And the next question is how to apply that rule to the facts that are before the court, and that means answering the question, did Mr. Post's slight movement within a single lane of traffic constitute erratic driving that provided that reasonable suspicion.
Well, if I could, Mr. Sure. Kelly, I mean, so I always get concerned at these arguments because sometimes I think both sides perhaps argue for a bit much. And your argument for erratic driving, and once again, I describe this totality of driving circumstances. I can envision a situation where you have someone that might have a weave in a lane, let's say the narrow lane, we're talking the 10-foot lane, and they're driving 10 miles under the limit. There's nothing erratic about the driving, but certainly, and we've heard mentioned this earlier, that might be one of the indicators that a person might be impaired. So when you put the two together, you might have enough. So I'm not sure that arguing erratic driving is taking you down the right path, because I can envision situations where the officer certainly has reasonable suspicion that there may be impaired driving, but the driving doesn't constitute, quote, erratic driving.
Well, I think in that scenario, Justice Butler, I think it might depend on what the speed limit is, but if a driver is driving so slowly that the driver is obstructing traffic or otherwise creating an unsafe condition, that might not be erratic driving, but it's unsafe driving. And so I would put that under the same umbrella of terms that would create reasonable suspicion. But I think we have to not just ask reasonable suspicion, but reasonable suspicion of what? This officer was investigating a suspicion of impaired driving. Well, impaired driving in Wisconsin means that the person has consumed enough alcohol that he or she is incapable of driving safely. And simply because somebody is driving a bit under the speed limit doesn't seem to me to suggest that the driver is incapable of driving safely, and that wouldn't justify pulling the driver over. Driving significantly under the speed limit so that the driver is actually driving in a hazardous way by obstructing traffic very well may.
But I think my point is not that the driver is driving slowly, but what an experienced trial judge should be looking at is the totality of, you look at the whole picture. How is the individual driving from point A to point B? And to take any one situation and single it out, as a former trial judge, it's just contrary to what I understood my obligation was as a trial judge. If it's totality of the circumstances, what is the picture that I'm looking at? Describe the driving to me. When the person was here, what did they do? When they were here, what did they do? When they were here, what did they do? And then you look at the whole picture, and based on that picture, was the officer's suspicion reasonable under the law? And that's really what you focused on. So if you just take a word like erratic and say that's got to be that, or if you just say weaving, or it's got to be that, or if you just say this or that, that seems to be contrary to the whole concept of totality. And that's what's bothering me about the argument.
I understand and I appreciate what you're saying, Your Honor. And I certainly agree that the court has to look at the totality of the circumstances, as does the officer on the scene. And I think trying to define some kind of a bright-line rule that will help police officers is difficult, given that there are so many facts. There are such a myriad of potential fact situations that police officers encounter on the road. But I think that one of the things the officer has to focus on in deciding whether the totality of the circumstances creates a reasonable suspicion is whether the particular circumstance that makes the officer think a stop is justified actually goes toward the violation that the officer wants to investigate. And there has to be some kind of a standard.
Also, let me ask you this then. If I'm driving and there's a car ahead of me and it's doing exactly what happened here, it's weaving or drifting, and it's 12 o'clock, well, I won't give you a time, but I call it in and I say, I don't know, I've been following this car for 4 or 5 blocks and it's weaving, and its license number is such and such, and my name is so and so. And then the officer comes out, and he or she stops the car. And then it's the same as in this case. There's a high blood alcohol. Would that be justified? And what's the difference?
I think it depends upon the quality of the information that
the
quality,
as I just told you, I've been following this car for 3 blocks. It's weaving back and forth within its lane.
I would hope that the officer or the dispatcher, whoever talked to the caller,
would say they could do nothing, but then after I do that, it goes down the road and it goes over and somebody's killed. These are judgment calls, aren't they?
They're always judgment calls,
yes.
but the police need to be guided
yes.
by the law, and I think that's what we're talking about. In the scenario, Justice Wilcox, that you're talking about, I don't know that the officer knows what weaving means in that context.
I would say exactly what it says. He's going, it's like an S. If he says, what's he doing? Well, he's going, Sherman described post driving as an S pattern. All I'm saying is that if you want your rule, which you said, the rule should be no traffic violation, then they would say, the next question, well, did he go out of his lane? I would say no.
But was it erratic or unsafe? That's what you...
And my next question to the person who called, because I think that's really just a substitute for the officer's own observation.
Well, that's what I'm just trying to...
And there's no problem, as long as the caller identifies himself or herself and is a reliable person, with relying upon somebody else's observations, but only if the officer...
I can go further. Then the officer... this is going to magnify this, but then the officer comes, the person is still in their own lane and driving within the speed limit, but weaving or drifting. I think under the rule that you're going to say is, well, because he's been doing it for so long, that would be different than when this was only a couple of blocks.
That would certainly be a factor. Another factor would be, what do you mean by weaving? Do you mean sharp, jerky movements? Do you mean going from boundary to boundary? Or do you mean sometimes you're over here and sometimes you're over here, but you're not always driving perfectly down the middle? And another factor that won't apply in every case, but certainly applies here and hasn't been discussed yet, is that Mr. Post was driving on a curve on the road. And I know we all drive a lot, and I know that police officers drive a lot, but I don't think their observations are necessarily any better than our observations in terms of understanding that a motorist who is driving on a curve is never going to maintain a perfect distance from the center line all the way around the curve. People correct while they're going around curves. And so if somebody describes that as drifting because sometimes he's a foot away from the center line, and sometimes he's 2 feet, and sometimes he's 3 feet, and then he's back to 2 feet, that, to me, is not suspicious. That's just normal driving. The other...
Sir,
yes?
Do I choose to give up or lessen? Lessen is a better word. Do I choose to lessen my Fourth Amendment rights of privacy by driving a car on the streets of Wisconsin?
As opposed to staying in your home, sir?
Well, as opposed to being a passenger in a car my husband's driving.
I think it's the same. Whether you're a passenger or a driver, you have a lesser expectation of privacy in a vehicle than you would have in a home. But that doesn't mean you have given up your right to privacy or, more importantly in this case, your right to liberty.
Well, should the weighing of what is reasonable suspicion be held differently for someone that's driving an automobile than someone who is riding in an automobile?
I'm having trouble envisioning a situation in which an officer would have reasonable suspicion to stop based on a passenger or a passenger's actions in the vehicle.
Okay. All right. Well, you could throw something out the vehicle. I mean, I could throw
litter
on the street, or there could be some reason to stop.
Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
Okay. Do you think the driver has a lessened privacy protection than the passenger, or do you think they're the same?
I think they're the same. I think that's just a fact of life by virtue of being in the same vehicle. If the officer sees a violation like littering, whether it's out the passenger window or the driver window, there's probable cause to stop the vehicle, and the other people in the vehicle may be suspicionless, and that might mean that they're free to get out of the car and walk away.
Well, you know what got me thinking about this is that, you know, you consent to giving a sample, a breath sample, when you're stopped for reasonable suspicion by virtue of the statutes, and we've held that. So otherwise, if you were just walking down the street, someone couldn't give you a breathalyzer, right? So I was just wondering if, because there's less protection in privacy because of that statute and you're accepting that statute as you drive, if there's any less protection of privacy in this regard we're talking about today when you drive.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think the implied consent statute only comes into play after the stop has been executed.
Mm-hmm. But it's still part of the Fourth Amendment protections, and we say, well, you've already agreed to give up this particular protection that you would have had otherwise.
Assuming that giving breath is a search in the first place that's covered by the Fourth Amendment, and I'm not sure that the law is all that clear in that regard. But I think we're not talking so much about a privacy interest here as we're talking about a liberty interest. We're talking about the right to drive down the street without
someone
being detained by the police, without having that freedom of movement end. And certainly the Supreme Court in Delaware against Proust, in Welch v. Wisconsin, has repeatedly said that that's a significant interest, that in a free society, we don't allow the police to stop our freedom of travel on a whim or on a hunch or because they feel like it. And that's why the Fourth Amendment, or the Supreme Court in interpreting the Fourth Amendment, has created a reasonable suspicion standard.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Kelly,
yes.
When I meet with experienced teachers, I will often ask them, have you noticed any changes in students over the years? Now, you're an experienced defense attorney. Have you noticed, in your experience, any changes in reasonable suspicion over the years?
Since Terry against Ohio. I would say that it's my observation, and I don't know that I'm any more qualified to make this observation than any other lawyer who reads Supreme Court cases and cases from other courts around the country, that there may be some erosion of Fourth Amendment protection over the years, and that the concept of what is reasonable suspicion may have broadened over the years. And I think in the context of driving, that has happened to some degree because of arguments like the argument the state is making here, that drunk driving is a menace, that we suffer from carnage on the highways, and it's important to give the police a lot of latitude and a lot of discretion to stop motorists. But I think the United States Supreme Court in Welch against Wisconsin said we really need to step back from that rationale. After all, the state of Wisconsin hasn't even made first offense drunk driving a crime. So how important can it be looking at this question legislatively? And is the fact that that statistics can be presented to a court about the potential danger of drunk driving, is that something that justifies backing away from Fourth Amendment protections? And I think the court in Welch pretty resoundingly said no. The Fourth Amendment is a protection even when we're talking about whatever potential ills might stem from drunk driving. I think one of the things that I was drawn to in reading all of the cases that both of our briefs present to the court is a sentence from the Tenth Circuit in United States against Lyons, which said, if failure to follow a perfect vector down the highway or keeping one's eyes on the road were sufficient reasons to suspect a person of driving while impaired, a substantial portion of the public would be subject each day to an invasion of their privacy. And I think that's the societal interest that's at stake here, and I think that's the framework that the court should keep in mind when it analyzes this question. This isn't a case in which a police officer sees a traffic violation. In those cases, the officer has probable cause to stop. And certainly the driver knows, if I break a traffic law, if I speed, if I go through a stop sign, if I do something else that is against the law, I expect that I will forfeit my freedom. I know that an officer is going to pull me over if an officer happens to see that happen. I think the balance is different when we're talking about an officer who doesn't see a traffic violation and who has, you know, a desire to stop a vehicle that hasn't violated any law. I think drivers who obey traffic laws rely upon the Fourth Amendment to protect them, and society relies upon the Fourth Amendment to protect drivers against zealous police officers who just want to check out their hunches.
Mr. Kelly, what about the observations of this officer, though? Observing what, as I understand in the record, was an S-safe shape driving over two blocks that cut across not 10 to 12 feet in the normal lane highway. We're talking about the normal lane highway plus the parking lane of 22 feet. So when an officer observes that type of S driving over a two-block period, over that width of driving, I guess tell me why that would not constitute reasonable suspicion that perhaps the driver was impaired.
Well, for two reasons. One is that the officer and the court need to look at the totality of the circumstances.
That's why I keep focusing on it. I don't like these broad rules, so talk in terms of the totality.
Okay. The totality of the circumstances is that the officer saw no lane deviation, saw no traffic violation, never saw Mr. Post's car get closer than a foot to the center line and no closer than 8 feet from the curb. That means that the space in which the vehicle moved, which is an 8-foot-wide vehicle, according to Sergeant Sherman, couldn't have been more than 2.5 feet to one side or 2.5 feet to the other side from a midpoint. Now that, when you're going around a curve, which is another factor that the court needs to consider, is not very much of a movement at all. We also know that when Mr. Post got to an intersection, he signaled his turn properly, he made a lawful turn, and he did that even though the car in front of him made an illegal turn, cut the turn short. And Sergeant Sherman somehow managed to stop both of these vehicles in one stop. But I think the totality of the driving does not suggest anything unsafe. It doesn't suggest any impairment on the part of Mr. Post. The second response is that I think if we examine the record a little more closely about what Sergeant Sherman means when he says S-shaped, we don't get very much information. Sergeant Sherman testified, and I think this is on page 5 of the transcript, that he was traveling, Mr. Post was traveling in an S-shaped manner. He was asked, what do you mean by that? His response was, well, it wasn't jerky. It was a smooth motion toward the right part of the parking lane and back towards the center line. And he was asked how many times that happened, and he said he didn't know. He couldn't say. I cross-examined him about that, and that's at page 14 of the transcript, and I asked him again, can you estimate the number of times the Cavalier moved? And he said, no, I can't. At another point, he said several times, and that's the word that I think the state has latched onto. But when I asked him, well, could it be a few times? He said, again, our words could be the same, a few and several. I think the critical testimony that comes out of that is that Sergeant Sherman really didn't know or couldn't remember or couldn't say how many times he saw the car move. But what we do know about the movement is that it took place on a curved road, and that it was not jerky or abrupt movement, and that he never got very close to the center line and certainly didn't get anywhere near the curb.
Also, can I ask you a question just on the facts? You said that this Cavalier was 8 feet wide?
That's the testimony of Sergeant Sherman.
It's pretty wide.
I know that not, I mean, That isn't correct, but I'm
going by the record, Your Honor.
Okay.
I haven't seen the car.
And you also said that it said, now I'm just looking at what I have, 6 feet of the curb, 6 to 8 feet from the curb, not 8 feet. So I just want to be, because I've tried to, I'm 6 foot two, and I remember trying to lay down the front seat of a Cavalier or the back seat.
Tell us another story, John.
And I'm in a U-shape.
Were you driving at the time?
I was resting.
Okay.
But that seemed to...
There's more width on the outside than there is on the bench seat on the inside. Page 12 was the testimony, Sergeant.
Same foot.
The sergeant testified his vehicle is 8 feet wide. Answer approximately yes. And that's the record.
Okay. Well,
he indicated at one point that the S is like 5 feet, which is you did it from the center, but if you move it from one side to the other, the S can be 5 feet.
From the farthest left where the left tires were to the farthest right where the right tires were was a 5 foot span on a 22-foot road. That is not a significant
drift. About
half
the table.
Probably.
You know, talk to the state about whether the rule should this be supported, be narrow or broad. But you have the same problem if we hold for you, Mr. Kelly. What this case says, so that we give enough guidance to law enforcement officers and to courts, right? Who have to.
Certainly.
I mean, all of these cases, everyone recognizes there's no clear bright line rule. You look at all the circumstances. That is the bright line rule. You look at all the circumstances.
Yes.
So the Court of Appeals said, we conclude there wasn't reasonable suspicion. I'm reading on 102. Posts, now this is their rule, slight deviations, which can be anywhere from 2.5 to 5 feet if we take all these measurements. Slight deviations within one lane of travel without nothing more does not, in our view, reach the quantum of evidence necessary to make the officer's hunch. And, of course, that's a code word that they're going to hold for you, right?
I agree with that.
Make the officer's hunch that Post might be intoxicated reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. Now, if you were writing an opinion in your favor, what would you write that makes sense under the body of law and doesn't tie the hands of law enforcement so that non-violations can still be reasonable suspicion? Because lawful circumstances in combination with other lawful circumstances can constitute reasonable suspicion. That's just clear law. So what do you write?
I think I would write much the same thing because I think the Court of Appeals got it right. In terms of the rule that I've tried to synthesize from courts around the country that have looked at this question, I think we have to distill a rule that makes sense in the context of impaired driving. If a police officer has a suspicion that a driver is unable to drive safely because of impairment, and that's what the violation is, that's what's against the law, not drinking, but drinking so much that you can't drive safely, then the question is, well, what kind of driving differentiates from ordinary driving that may be imperfect but is so prevalent that it doesn't raise a level of suspicion that the person is incapable of driving safely? And I don't think it's a semantic distinction to draw a distinction between erratic driving, which might include weaving, meaning repeatedly moving from boundary to boundary, or changing position abruptly or in a jerky way, or driving so unpredictably that the driver is creating a genuine reason to fear that the driver can't drive safely, and driving that is more common, drifting, not staying perfectly in the same spot, not maintaining a perfect vector down the middle of the road, particularly when the driver is going around a curve, which
is awfully difficult. Where does it say curve?
I'm sorry?
Where is it in the record that this is a curve?
It's in the transcript. The page number I might be able to find for you quickly, but
was it entirely a curve? Was it all a curve?
It's page 10. Page 10?
Page 10.
I'm getting help from my adversary here. It's page 10 of the reply brief and footnote.
All right. Okay, what a street kind of curves around as you are driving north on it? The question. It would be curving toward the west. Is that right? Correct.
Yes.
So we don't know how steep a curb it is.
We don't.
It could have been very gentle.
If you look at Google Maps, you see that it follows the Wisconsin River, and it curves gradually at first and then sharply. But that's not in the record yet.
We haven't taken judicial notice of Google yet.
I'm waiting for that to happen.
All right. We may be on our way. I'm sorry, was there another question?
Okay. I guess in summary, it seems to me that the balance the court needs to strike is a balance between a driver's liberty interest in being able to drive, perhaps imperfectly, but lawfully down the road with a fair expectation that the person's not going to experience an interruption of his or her liberty, versus law enforcement's legitimate interest in stopping people who are reasonably suspected of driving while impaired. It seems to me that looking at the totality of the circumstances in this case, that balance favors Mr. Post. Because he was not driving erratically, nobody suggested that his driving was unsafe in any way. He certainly didn't come close to crossing the center line. He didn't get anywhere near the curb. He may not have driven in a perfectly straight line around a curve, but he didn't deviate very much. And the record just doesn't tell us how many times he deviated from some imaginary midpoint. Given those facts, I don't think that it was objectively reasonable for a police officer to suspect that Mr. Post was driving while impaired by the consumption of alcohol. Rather, that's the kind of driving that is so normal and so commonplace that it doesn't give rise to that level of suspicion. And looking at the totality of the circumstances, I think, leaves only one answer, and that answer is that the Court of Appeals got it right when it engaged in what is a fairly fact-intensive review, and that's what the Court of Appeals does. And it concluded that there simply wasn't a reasonable suspicion here. I think that conclusion should be affirmed.
Counselor, does it bear on the totality of the circumstances that when the officer first saw Mr. Post, he was, as he said, canted into the parking lane, so he was driving along partially in the parking lane. And then as he began to follow him, he began to weave. Does that make any difference from your perspective?
I'm not sure what canted means. I take it to mean that he was closer to the parking lane than the car in front of him, which was closer to the center line. But there is only one lane. It's a really wide lane. But we know from the record that Mr. Post never got within 8 feet of the curb, and assuming that most cars are at least no wider than 8 feet, it sounds to me like he didn't enter some imaginary parking lane. So I don't think it does make a difference. I think that in a lane that isn't laned beyond the fact that it's a wide lane, you can drive anywhere you want. And motorists typically do drive wherever they want. If they're going to make a right turn, they drive farther over to the right. If they're planning on making a left turn, they drive more toward the center. If they're going to be on the road a while, maybe they stay in the middle. I don't think that's a factor that creates suspicion.
Is it your position that in a lane that's 22 feet wide, yet still a single lane, that you can make an S, drive in an S fashion going from 1 foot to the center line and 1 foot to the curb line, but as long as you're not violating the law, there's no reasonable suspicion?
That's a much closer case because I think that comes closer to what courts have called weaving as opposed to drifting, because the movement is so exaggerated. It's going from lane boundary to lane boundary, and particularly if that happens repeatedly, I think that might create an inference that this is not a safe driver. But moving a little bit in a narrow part of a wide lane doesn't seem to me to create that same inference. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Frymuth?
Thank you. A couple of things first on the legal question presented. I think with respect to both the privacy interest and the government interest, which is what's at stake when you're determining reasonable suspicion, I think the Sitz case is the answer to the Welch case, if you will. Sitz is the checkpoint sobriety case, which suggests, or doesn't suggest, but indicates that or states that you don't need reasonable suspicion. And the reason for that, underlying all that, of course, is that it is viewed, the drunk driving is viewed as such a significant problem.
But my understanding of the Zitz case is that the states are allowed to set up sobriety checkpoints as long as they do them randomly and they're not targeting specific individuals or specific vehicles. That's a far cry different from the Welsh situation, as I understand.
Sure. All I'm suggesting is that when you're looking at interest here, though, we're looking at something we're looking at a significant interest here when we're talking about making an investigative stop for possible drunk driving.
I thought you were going to say Welsh involved the police officers going into the house.
It did.
I mean, it was that there was a car left on the side of the road, concept that he was intoxicated, close following. They entered a house without a warrant. Ultimately, it was settled out on consent of the daughter, I believe it was, but that was an entry into a home.
Exactly, and that was the problematic part of that decision. And that problematic part stems in part from not criminalizing first offense drunk driving. Also on the individual privacy aspect, there is no constitutional right to drive a car, and as Justice Rogensack suggested, there is a diminished expectation when it comes to being stopped for drunk driving, what an officer can do then when that blossoms into reasonable suspicion or probable cause to believe that there's drunk driving. Also, this court, I believe, in Rutzinski and the Court of Appeals in Waldner, makes it clear, contrary to this, to the underpinnings of the proffered rule of the defense, that an officer isn't required to rule out innocent behavior before making a stop. That's in fact, the essence of reasonable suspicion is to resolve ambiguity. Just on the legal aspect of this, one of the difficulties with the Court of Appeals decision here, I think, is its very, if I may, truncated recitation of what happened here. Merely calling it slight deviations within a lane really doesn't give any context to or discusses the specific facts, which is part of the difficulty, I think, with certainly why we are challenging that opinion. It just does not develop any kind of facts.
So if we were to hold with you or against you, you want us to state the facts? Because that's the only ground.
Absolutely. Whichever way this court comes down, I think it's important, especially the court has taken this case, is to indicate at least some minimum, if you will, level that amounts to reasonable suspicion for drunk driving when you've got this type of situation. This eludes publication typically in Wisconsin because until you get the fifth offense, you don't have a felony, and therefore you usually have one judge court of appeals opinions on this. With respect to the facts, just a couple of quick points. The testimony about driving on a curve really wasn't developed, and it's not at least clear to me from the record exactly what point in the road we're talking about here, if this was the two blocks in which the swerving was observed or whether this was before or after exactly the interaction of that. So to put too much emphasis on that fact, I think, would be going beyond what's really apparent from the record. Also, at the beginning of this, what prompted the officer to start following here was the fact that canting, and the officer explained that to me, he viewed the post car as driving in the parking lane, and that was what prompted him to get behind and start following.
I thought part of this was that he also viewed that Post was driving along with, in tandem, following, whatever you want to call it, of the preceding car. So that
he doesn't explain how he knew that.
Right.
I mean, after the fact, when they both stopped, which I'm not even clear why the first car would have necessarily stopped. Usually it's the car immediately be in front of the officer. But in any case, I think that's what his judgment that this was tandem was probably stemmed from. But it's not developed in the record beyond that, as far as I know.
What happened with the other car? Do we know?
I don't know from this record.
Thank you.
Mr. Freimuth, if I could, I just saw your red light came on.
Okay.
There's one thing that troubles me about the trial court's written decision, and I don't know if he expounded on this in the oral decision, so that's what I'm asking you about now, or whether he had an oral decision. But when the decision is two pages, and when he gets to the part that discusses discusses why he's doing what he's doing. This is on page 105 of your appendix. The court finds that based on the training and experience of Officer Sherman, drifting even within one's own lane gives a suspicion that the driver may have been intoxicated. He further testified that drifting even in one's own lane is a clue of intoxication and, in his experience, unusual driving. What troubles me about this decision is it does not appear to be based upon the facts of the case. It seems to be based solely upon the officer's training and experience. And in looking at the totality of the circumstances, that has to take into account the driving. Do you know, because I didn't go back and reread the transcript, do you know if the judge expounded on his decision as part of the transcript?
I don't believe he did so. The full transcript of the suppression hearing is appended, and I do not believe he did so. Actually, in fairness to the Court of Appeals, the trial court's decision here also really didn't, as you're pointing out, discuss the specific facts or specifically enough, other than basically drawing legal conclusions here without elaborating.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frymuth. Thank you, Mr. Kelly, for another reasonable suspicion case. As you can see, the court is familiar with driving and has its own set of problems relating thereto. So thank you for this discussion. That closes the case of 2005 AP 2778 CR State versus Robert E. Post. The court is adjourned for the February arguments and will reconvene to hear March arguments as scheduled. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:10 promptly. Thank you.
3 o'clock.